Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program that looks at the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the prospects for our kids to get a job and to have a decent life. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University here in New York City, where the program originates. We're going to have a very exciting program today. In the future, I'm going to be bringing more of the kinds of guests we're going to have this time, and there will be historians of one kind or another to make us aware of how much we can learn from the history of the United States. Today, I'm going to start, as usual, with some short updates. The first one is simply so remarkable, if that's the right word, that I couldn't resist. Larry Summers is a chaired professor at Harvard and used to be the president of Harvard until he made some statements that lost him that position. He's been an advisor to the President Obama, among others, the director of the National Economic Council, and so on. He wrote in his own blog on the 17th of May a long, impassioned article about why the Ukraine, currently in a struggle with Russia, should be allowed not to pay its debts. The Ukraine should not be allowed to pay its debts. Mr. Summers has not, so far, written a passionate article of which I'm aware as to why the Greek people ought not to be allowed or ought to be allowed to do so. The Greek situation doesn't seem to attract attention, neither of Mr. Summers nor of many others. But the Ukraine does. So I thought I'd remind you, in this spirit of a little history, that back in 1953, as I've pointed out on this program earlier, the German government, reeling from the collapses of that country after World War II, the German government was deeply in debt. And it was also being asked by the United States, especially, to become a bulwark of the Cold War opposition to the Soviet Union at that time. And the Germans cleverly put this situation together, went to the French, British, and Americans and said, we can't rebuild Germany to be a bulwark against the Soviet Union if we're using all of our money that we could use to build up our economy and instead paying off these debts to France, Britain, and the United States. All through 1953, there were conferences, mostly held in London, about all of this. And then toward the end of 1953, an agreement was reached. I bet many of you can guess what the agreement involved. Well, let me tell you. Half of Germany's debt was simply erased, and the other half was rewritten to last 30 years. It effectively meant that Germany no longer had to pay a significant amount of interest or amortization on its debts. So it looks like when you're opposed to Soviet Union and Russia, Germany then, Ukraine now, you merit debt reduction. But if you're Greece and you're led by a socialist or left-wing government, you don't. So much for economics untampered with by politics. The next few updates are really all of a piece, so I'm going to call them signs of a broken system, of a system whose priorities are so out of whack that they don't really need much comment, so I'm just going to run through them quickly. From the ILO, which you can read, good reports come from them, ILO.org, 57 of the lower income countries out of a list of 185 that they monitor, the 57 lowest income countries, for them to get the coverage, universal benefits, medical benefits, for all pregnant women and children. And I singled that out because that's the future of all of those countries, pregnant women and the children that they will bear. To give them the health coverage, the support, the food necessary to make a real difference in the future of those countries compared to the past, would take money. And the ILO has calculated how much money it would take. And they did a lovely statistic, which I have to repeat to you. They asked how much money it would cost to give universal care, that's the best care, to pregnant women and children in the 57, the lowest third of countries around the world. Here's what it would be. 0.6%. That's less than 1% of what the 20 richest countries gave to their financial sectors to bail them out of the crisis in 2008. For those of you that like the statistics, 0.6% of the total amount to bail out the financial sector in the G20 countries of the world. A second statistic or fact that are signs of a broken system. Over the last 6 years, child poverty increased in 18 of the 28 countries of the European Union. In other words, it's not just the poorest third, but in 18 of the 28 countries in what is arguably the richest part of the world, child poverty increased in the majority of countries in Europe, a big majority. As of 2012, and here I thank the Institute for Women's Policy Research in Washington, D.C., Heidi Hartman's outfit, 44% of California workers over 18 lacked access to a single paid sick day. 44% of California workers over 18 lacked access to a single paid sick day, which means if you're sick, you continue to work, which means you get sicker in most cases, which means you postpone care, which means your illness will be more serious, and it also means, with any luck, you can infect your fellow workers. All of this to save the employer from providing sick days. But perhaps the best one, and I chose this in part because my guests later on in the program are geographers, is what's being called Billionaire's Row outside of Central Park. Central Park, for those of you that are not New Yorkers, is a wonderful facility here in New York City, the largest park we have. But currently, billionaires have decided they want to have apartments with lovely views of Central Park. So particularly at 472 Park Avenue and several others, huge, tall, billionaire apartment houses are being erected. The latest one caused a bit of a scandal when the penthouse at the top went for $95 million. That was the purchase price. Here's the issue being fought out in New York. Turns out these tall buildings cast long shadows. And when the sun begins to go down in the afternoon, Central Park, large parts of it, will be going dark in a way that they never have. Billionaires, and we're talking 10 or 20 of them, want an apartment with a view. So the millions of New Yorkers that use the park will have no sun for many hours of the day. Is there a need for a comment on this? Final sign of a broken system. This was in the borough of Queens in New York, and I thank here the Daily News, not a newspaper I often thank, but I want to thank them. They carried a story on PS 120 in Queens. They had a fun day carnival on the 21st of May. 900 children had the opportunity to go outside on slides and bouncing rooms and have a wonderful time as a festival towards the end of the school year. But each family of those kids had to pay $10. 100 children couldn't. That is, they and their families couldn't come up with the $10. They were excluded while all the other children, the other 800, went into the outside area of the school, enjoyed themselves, the noise clearly audible, while in a darkened auditorium, the other 100 kids who didn't have the $10 were kept for the entirety of this time. When the principal, Joan Monroe, was asked how she could possibly justify this, her answer, well, it's stunning. It wouldn't be fair, that was her word, fair, F-A-I-R. It wouldn't be fair to those who had paid the $10 to provide an enjoyable time for the other 100 who couldn't afford it. The concept of fair justified what PS 120 thought it ought to do. Moving right along, Over the last 2 weeks, four banks pled guilty to yet another crime. The biggest banks in this country are specialists in this activity. This time, the four were Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Barclays, and the Royal Bank of Scotland. So bad were their crimes that they together will pay $6 billion in fines. Let's see now. This comes at the end of the same banks and a bunch of other big ones, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, the biggest in the country, having been caught and either admitted or not admitted and paid fines to the following: manipulating interest rates, the LIBOR scandal in London, manipulating the whole mortgage crisis and funding that led to the collapse in 2008, laundering money, taking money from illegal operations and running it through the system so it's not clear where the money came from, and charging fees they shouldn't have charged. This latest thing was that they pled guilty to was manipulating currency exchange rates in the world economy. Okay, what's to be said about this? Well, again, not to stretch credulity here, here's a thought. If a public enterprise in this country were run in such a way that over a period of 5 years, every major kind of business that enterprise was involved in was shown to have been illegally or unethically manipulated for the private profit of a handful of shareholders, the cry to get rid of such a public enterprise and privatize it would be deafening. Just as deafening, but in the sense of silence is louder than anything, is the silence that accompanies these pleadings of guilty, these payments of huge fines. These companies are doing illegal acts, have been doing them for years, as many of the documents show, are making an amount of money that makes these fines the proverbial slap on the wrist. What's the alternative? Public banking system. That'd be one. Make banks cooperative enterprises, because if a lot of people, a lot of tellers, a lot of middle managers knew what was going on, we'd finally get that transparency about our financial sector that everybody talks about, but that somehow eludes us. With lots of people involved in the decision making, with public banking competitively positioned against them, they wouldn't get away with what they have gotten away with so long. But the silence on this topic from our political leaders is deafening and tells you where whose bread is buttered. I want to also quickly talk about two items that came up this week. Nebraska joined 18 other states in overthrowing the death penalty. You will not be put to death in the state of Nebraska anymore. It still means that a majority of states in the United States have the death penalty and do put people. Now, why would I bring this up in a program on economics? Well, I discovered two interesting things. One, that one of the reasons Nebraska folks gave for voting, the majority of their legislature voted to override the governor's veto, so this is serious final decision, is because European companies produce the lethal drugs that are used to inject people to kill them. And the European companies have refused to provide any such drugs to American prisons. Why might that be? Well, let's see. Maybe because every European country has outlawed the death penalty for decades. Maybe that's the reason. But it's hard to get it. And if you can't kill people with a lethal injection, what are you to do? Utah shows the way. Utah is the first state in the United States to have decided to switch from the injections, which they can't get, to a firing squad. That's the law in Utah, and Arkansas, Wyoming, and Idaho are considering using firing squads as well. You think something might be amiss in a country going this direction? Well, maybe. But hats off to the folks in Nebraska. The other economic dimension of this was the discussion between those who favored repealing their death penalty, who argued that it's very expensive to kill people. And the counter-argument echoing in the halls of the Nebraska legislature was, yeah, but put them in jail for the rest of their life. That's expensive, too. A decision about life and death made in part by a discussion of which is the cheaper alternative. Last item, quickly. A spectacular set of arrests in a major hotel, five-star hotel in Zurich, Switzerland, and with corresponding actions by legal authorities elsewhere, basically arresting most of the leadership of the global soccer institution, FIFA by name. Turns out they have been bribed by all manner of folks in the tune of billions of dollars, billion, would it be, and that they've been doing it for decades. Well, I'm going to set aside the question why billions and billions of dollars of corrupt money, bribery, and so on went undetected for decades in an association where, according to what I've been reading, hundreds of people must have known what's going on. Put that aside. Put also aside the question of whether soccer is probably or likely going to be the only sport that has this problem. Put that aside. Here's the thought I would like to leave you with. Sports was once, as in ancient Greece, something people did as part of the society's communal life. The enjoyment of it, the training for it, the watching it, the enjoyment in what the human body can achieve. In our modern capitalist system, it's a business. It's wrapped up in capitalist money-making. And so we really shouldn't be surprised, should we, if that's how we organize it, that we end up with these results. Don't forget it the next time you watch sports. Okay. The second part of this program, as always, has to do with my responding to some of your questions, and these are indeed important for us on this occasion. First one. And this was so poignant, I was going to read to you what came in before I provide an answer. So this is reading from an email received literally a few days ago. I am currently pursuing my PhD in philosophy at an underfunded state school. I've blocked out the name of it. Much of your economic analysis of higher education reflects what I see day in and day out on my campus. Moreover, as I have exceeded my funding, I find myself cobbling together a meager income among several adjunct positions and a low-paying hourly job with no promising prospects in the field that I have spent the better part of a decade preparing to enter. All of this makes me wonder what possible alternatives are yet to be realized in reorganizing and reconceiving education. To put it simply, how do you see worker self-directed enterprises applying to colleges and universities? Is there a possible way to organize a truly democratic campus wherein democracy extends from the highest offices to the first-year undergraduate student? Well, the first thing I want to do is congratulate this person who's largely answered his or her own question. That's right. Higher education, where I have spent my entire adult life, is a disaster. It's a disaster in terms of what it's doing, or better spoken, not doing for its students. It's a disaster that having become part of the capitalist economic machinery, it values the funding and the budget of the institution way beyond anything in the realm of education broadly understood, at least anything that I've ever understood. It has substituted for the old idea of a professor with the time and the support to be the best teacher he or she can be, this using of adjuncts clearly in order to save money and putting young people in a dead-end situation that physically and mentally exhausts them while diminishing what they can deliver to their students. I could go on and on. The schools that I've been associated with, Yale in particular, is really less of an institution of learning now than it is a large corporation. Its biggest business is running dozens of hospitals around the Northeast, which it has found to be much more lucrative than dealing with students. So I understand the question. One of the solutions I would advocate, but that's not a surprise for those of you who know what I talk about on this program, would indeed be a radical reorganization of the university. It was never a democratic place. It played at democracy. In all the institutions that I've taught, I was active on the faculty senate or the faculty committees, but our function was always advisory. It was polite. It was something that most faculty members did not participate in because it was kind of boring. And the net result of what you did most of the time was marginal. The decisions were made by a tiny number of administrators who were usually responsible to a private board, that would be in a place like Yale, or to public authorities in the case of public universities. The students were at the low end of the totem pole, and the staff, which was often the largest part of the population, had no effective input whatsoever other than these formalities for the faculty. So I think it would be a radically good idea to reorganize universities, to open it up to a democratic process, to allow the students to talk about what they feel, not because they should make the decision rather than other people, but that the decisions should be made with students and faculty and a much more reduced position for the administrators. But of course, to solve the problem of the university, deeply entrenched in the society as it is, requires other changes as well. The transformation of the whole economy into a more democratic and cooperatively organized institution would be a crucial way to support and reinforce the democratization of the university. What we've had instead is that the capitalism that has squelched democracy in the largest society has, particularly in recent decades, done the same to our universities, which is doubly interesting because the majority of people who go to universities and colleges in America go to public institutions. Higher education in America is an overwhelmingly public enterprise, not a private enterprise. So you might have expected, naively, that because it is a public enterprise, it would first and foremost serve the public, but it has more replicated private capitalist enterprises than anything else in shaping its evolution. The other question, I wish I had more time, but I want to stab at it in the minutes we have left. The other question has to do with what I said earlier in an earlier program about the household. The household is organized as an economic system because a lot of work is done there. Raw food is made into meals. Dirty rooms are cleaned. That's work. But muscles, brains, people transform raw materials into finished products. That's what they do in enterprises. So the household is a place where production occurs. And from a critical perspective, that leads one to ask, well, if it's where work occurs, do we have employer-employee? Do we have some people producing more than they themselves get and producing that as a surplus and as a go to somebody else? And as I explained, the household is a place where some people produce more than they themselves consume. Typically, in a traditional household, that person is the wife. She produces meals. Just for herself? No. For everybody. And she cleans the bed she shares with her partner. Does she clean it just her side? Or the partner's side, too? She cleans both sides, doesn't she? And she does a lot of other work, our typical housewife. And she produces a lot of output. She consumes, but she also produces more. And who gets that? Well, we know in feudalism, the serf produces a surplus, goes to the lord. In slavery, the slave produces more than he or she gets, and that goes to the master. And we know in capitalism that the worker produces more than it gets paid, and that's called profit. But what is it in the household? Well, we did that last time. And I tried to point out that in the household, it's the wife in the traditional household who produces a surplus that belongs to the husband, is taken by the husband, who then distributes it in a variety of ways. And we went through that. And the letter came, and I want to thank this person. We don't use the names of the people unless they give us explicit permission to do that. This person wrote in, I don't mind saying, he's clearly a man, because he was outraged that I was giving too little credit to the husband. What about the husband who, and he lists it, I was charmed by this, he lists it as fixing the toilet, mowing the lawn, raking the leaves, cleaning out the gutters, washing the car, and so on. The husband, he wanted to stress, does work too, and so indeed he does. But let's be careful here. There are many capitalists, particularly in small firms, who work alongside their workers, don't they? But they're still the capitalists. They still get the profit. But they can choose, and many do, to work. The husband can still get the surplus, but choose to work somehow alongside the wife. That would be not a change in the inequality, but it would be the husband choosing to do something he might otherwise not do. But it would be very different if the very basis of the household and the marriage were a shared work. When the household was a collectivized workplace where husband and wife decided together what the work was, shared it on the basis of their shared decision-making, how to do it. Then you wouldn't have the worker producing a surplus for the other. You'd have a collectivity, which millions of young people these days are precisely pursuing. They want a different household that isn't a subordinated wife. How interesting. How interesting not to have at home what exists so obviously in the larger society. Maybe the revolutions of the future will surprise us. They won't move from the larger economy into the household. They'll go exactly in the other direction. We've come to the end of the first half of our program. I want to thank you all for being with us today and ask you please to stay with us for a very short break when we will be back for the second half of this program. Welcome back, folks. I want to begin this second half of our program today by reminding you of the two websites that we maintain, I'm very sure that our conversation with our guests today will inspire you to write even more than you normally do. So please let me remind you, rdwolf2fs.com is one, and the other one is democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites will allow you to comment on today's program, to raise questions, to send us your criticisms, to let us know what you would like us to do on this program, and in particular, how you reacted to what you're about to hear. Indeed, you can also use those websites to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, to share, of course, all of these things with friends through your own social media, and also, and very, very important for us, is to make use of all that we put on those websites. We update them daily with analyses of the sort that we produce on this program and many others, and we do that in order to facilitate your use of them. And we'll have some more to say about that toward the end of the program. So let me begin by welcoming my two guests. First, Dr. Richard, or should I call you Professor Richard Walker. Richard Walker, the Professor Emeritus of Geography at the University of California in Berkeley. He taught there from 1975 to 2012. He was the chair of the Geography Department and many other things there. He's written a number of books. The most recently is The Atlas of California, 2013. He has gotten Fulbright and Guggenheim Fellowships, a Distinguished Scholarship Award of the Association of American Geographers. And only if I had more time could I go through all of the other things that he has achieved and accomplished in a long and distinguished career. My other guest is Dr. Gray Brecken. He's a historical geographer as well. He's an author. He's been a journalist and a TV producer in San Francisco. He went through the program at the University of California at Berkeley in geography with Richard Walker, achieved his PhD there. He has written a number of books, including award-winning Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. He is a frequent radio and television guest, and he is going to be talking with us, together with Professor Walker, about what they call the Living New Deal Project at the University of California in Berkeley. So let's begin by having you tell our audience very briefly what that is and why you set it up.
Well, the Living New Deal is an effort to document and map online everything that all public works that the New Deal produced. It turns out that this is an immense riches of post offices, libraries, improved parks, even humble sewers and sidewalks and so on, all over the United States. Every state had thousands of these sites, and no one ever actually documented it or created a final report on the New Deal, and that's what we're doing. And it's all online at livingnewdeal.org with a wonderful map. You can go in there and find your city, your town, your state, and find what was done by the New Deal there.
And add to it.
And we have about 10,000 sites now, but there must be at least 100,000 by the time we'll be done.
Were all of these built by the unemployed that got hired by the United States government as an anti-unemployment solution in that period?
Essentially, yes. I mean, these were projects. Many of them were sort of on the books, ready to go when the country collapsed in the Great Depression. State governments were all bankrupt. And so the federal government came in and worked with the states and with cities, municipalities, to carry out projects that they already wanted. And that, you know, injected the money to do this. And some of them were done through contractors, and others were done through direct hiring of the unemployed.
Okay. Anything to add, Gray Brecken?
Well, yes. One of the problems we have is that the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, is the best known of those agencies. It employed 8.5 million people. But there was the Civilian Conservation Corps, which hired another 3.5 million. There was the Public Works Administration. There were so many different agencies. And they all left us stuff, and stuff that we're using every day without knowing where it came from. I often liken it to an excavation of a lost civilization, a very strange civilization that my parents built their generation built, and then they forgot to tell us about it. But it was also then buried by the hot lava and ash of reaction of the plutocrats who always hated it right from the beginning, hated Roosevelt and all. And so we're digging this up. It's a marvelous thing because I call it the lost ethical language of New Deal public works, which I've been learning about for the last 10 years studying it. It was a very different value set than the one that we've become used to. It put the stress on cooperation and community rather than competition. And the people in the New Deal, many of whom had worked in the settlement house movement, like Eleanor Roosevelt, for example, their concern was using government to increase the education that was available to people, but also the health, the public health and the individual health of people who had lost it through no fault of their own. So it's a very, very different value system. And that's particularly what interests me, as well as often finding extraordinarily beautiful objects that they created and left to us.
So it's kind of a political act that you're correcting for. That is, there's been a kind of collective forgetting or burying all of the impacts, consequences, almost as a way of the New Deal, as a way to pretend it kind of never happened, and that you're bringing that forward, if I'm understanding you rightly, because of your interest in making people aware of what was achieved then and how much of it is still being made use of by the American
people. That's right. People remember the New Deal perhaps because Social Security was created then, unemployment insurance and so on, public housing programs. But they think, well, that was just a short term. The rest of it was just make work, kind of get the economy out of it, the Great Depression, and then forget it. But in fact, there was this immense public investment that produced all this infrastructure of buildings and roads, thousands of miles of highway, electrification of the country, as well as these beautiful, a few objects that we do remember, like the murals in post offices that everybody loves so much. So that part, though, was a long-term investment in the United States and was actually essential to the prosperity in the United States after World War II. And people don't think of that. The New Deal was seen as just this quick 10 years, hire a bunch of unemployed people to maybe dig ditches. And it was much, much more than that. It has a long-term impact. That's why we call it the Living New Deal, because it's there all around us and people are unaware of it.
And it saved the lives of millions of people, like Ronald Reagan's family. His father got a job with the WPA. But we're also, as Dick said, we're using it all the time, and we're the beneficiaries of it. You know, when I first went to the University of California at Berkeley, a public school, in 1967, it was virtually free. And so the students today, they can't even conceive of such a thing at this point.
I've been told that the national parks that so many Americans enjoy and visit, that some or all or many of them had major part of their creation or their improvement or their enlargement happening with unemployed people in the 1930s.
Yeah, that's the CCC mostly, also some WPA, but almost all the parks, all the parks that existed at that time had all their improvements, the buildings, the trails, the picnic tables, all that was done by CCC workers. So it made the parks usable, much more usable for the public. And then after World War II, it was an explosion of outdoor recreation because of that.
But also because of the supply of cheap labor, the parks themselves were tremendously expanded at that time, as were the national forests.
Well, they bought much more park land. Many new parks came into existence, like Olympic National Park.
So we literally are enjoying, in that example, we literally are enjoying the fruits of the investment made by hiring unemployed people to do these things.
Exactly. And of course, I mean, in New York, for example, we've found, we've already identified over 1,000 sites. So there's still
New York State or city?
City. Mm-hmm. And there's, swimming pools people are still using. And of course, dare I say it, the sewers that are still flushing away your waste, a lot of that was New Deal production. Water mains and so on, as well as improvements to Central Park, the Bronx Zoo, Bronx Parks and Bronx Zoo and so on.
All right, let's jump in, given your very helpful introduction. Let's jump into some of the big questions. Right? Already, well, from the little bit you've told us, it's clear that the people and the government of the United States, facing a Great Depression in the 1930s, took extraordinary steps to give unemployed people work, producing useful things for the public as a whole. Whereas in the current crisis since 2008, nothing like that has happened. Talk to us. Help us understand why the reaction was so different then from what it is now.
Well, I think part of it is just the genius of Roosevelt and the New Dealers around him, people like Harry Hopkins, that they, you have to remember at that time, the federal government was so much smaller. It's the New Deal that actually created the modern federal government, a much larger government with things like Social Security taking care of all pensioners. But then at that, you know, America has this long history of sort of anti-government thought, and the federal government is rather small. But faced with the Great Depression, they were willing to take extraordinary actions because people were suffering, because the economy had been in a downward spiral for 4 years from 29 to 33 when Roosevelt came in. They had to make it up as they went. And that's what's so surprising. Now, the political forces, of course, were different. We can talk about that. But I think we shouldn't miss the genius and the willingness to experiment, to do what was necessary to relieve the suffering of common people, which I don't think we saw in the same way in the Great Recession.
But I think we should also remember, you know, the Roosevelts were both conservative and radical at the same time. I mean, they're American aristocrats. Roosevelt did not want to see a revolution, and the country was moving towards one. This is one of the things that the right doesn't acknowledge. The country was very close to a revolution or another civil war. And so Roosevelt realized you had to take pressure off of that system to make sure that it didn't blow. Both of the Roosevelts, Eleanor and Franklin, they had a comprehensive moral vision about how government should help all of the people rather than those who could just afford to buy it. And that is completely lacking now.
Well, help us to understand. What is it? Do we have today leaders that are so inferior, I don't know what other word to use, to what Dick just described, and so we don't see it? Or do we have a non-revolutionary pressure from below that relieves the people at the top from any need, in their minds at least, to do something? Well, how do you explain it is what I want.
Well, it is in some ways hard to explain. I mean, some of these are the quirks of history. But it's true the social forces were different at the time. You had a working class movement that had been building dramatically in the early 20th century. It had been suppressed in the 20s, but it was ready to come back. So you had a pretty mobilized working class who thought of themselves much more as a working class than today, where it's really been scattered in so many ways. You had immigrants and the children of immigrants who had, you know, come in and by the millions, who, you know, saw America as the opportunity and were optimistic about America. And then you had certain kind of party structures like the Democratic South Democratic Party was more unified at that time, so it could back Roosevelt in a way, joining the northern working class and the southern, the old solid Democratic South, to vote through a lot of this legislation. Today, the immigrants and their children, they voted for Obama. I think that's what's interesting. I mean, he got elected twice. Who elected him? But whereas a lot of the old white working class was much more conservative, had gone to the right. We also had 40 years of, since Reagan, of neoliberalism and this lesson to people that government is the problem, that, you know, we have to cut taxes. And people didn't really, they couldn't blame government for the Great Depression because the federal government wasn't big enough to be the cause. So, and there was also, of course, a history of really strong anti-bank populism, which helped Roosevelt when he shut the banks, when he, you know, they went through and they just cleaned out the 10% of the banks that clearly they were going to go under, and they completely reformed the banking system. That was the first thing they did, really, and they didn't just kiss up to the bankers and to Wall Street the way Obama did. So the leadership at the top, which may have been elected by the American people, we should give them credit. They knew something was wrong. The leadership top didn't react. I think Obama also, in fairness, didn't have Hoover before him. Bush created the problem. The Bush administration was in charge. But the Great Recession hit just as before Obama came in, whereas Hoover had 4 years of the downward spiral. So people could clearly see that Republicans had no solution. And they were desperate, and they needed a solution, and they were willing to give. And Congress, everybody, even a lot of business, was willing to give Roosevelt a chance to do something dramatic to solve what seemed to be a death spiral of the economy.
I think we also have to take into account the degree to which the mass media, as part of this reaction, has moved so far to the right. Two words, Rupert Murdoch. But it's not just the corporate media. It's NPR, PBS as well, too. What people don't realize is what they're not hearing. I suspect you probably haven't been invited on to the NewsHour to give your perspective, let alone Noam Chomsky or anybody else. And perhaps it's because you're so obscure. No, it's because you're not. So the viewers, of course, are denied that perspective so that they don't even know that there is a left in the United States. And I think that really has a great deal to do with what we're seeing, as well as the rise of spectacular sports and other entertainment delivered to you through digital devices, the greatest dope ever invented.
Is it your perspective that because in the 1930s, would you agree to this or not? In the 1930s, Americans were able, in a bad economic situation, to recognize that an active interventionist government was a major thing for them to hope for and to place their confidence in. Whereas today, whatever the causes of it are, we have a population that just doesn't believe that and therefore doesn't know quite what to do. Clearly the banks are playing with us, to be as polite about it as we can, but no one knows where to go because the notion of empowering the government to fix this thing is a non-starter, at least so far. Is that, do you agree with that, or is there something you would say that is different from that?
Oh, no, I totally agree, because people would feel much different about their taxes if they could see it coming back to their communities in swimming pools, parks, sewers, airports, schools, etc., which they don't see now. Quite the opposite. They see the decay of everything. But again, what's missing from the picture is 50%. Over 50% of the budget is now going to the military. It wasn't at that time. And the other thing is that there was an absence of scandal in those public works at that time. So people really did have a much different attitude towards the government at that time.
Well, you have, if I could interject, it's even worse, it seems to me, because what you have, the money isn't coming back to the people in the form of services and supports they need and want and would be enjoying every day. So they become even more anti-tax. That is, they are trained to explain the failure to deliver services as a rationale for not wanting to pay taxes. So then the taxes are cut, which requires the services to be cut, and you're in a downward spiral.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That we seem to be now at the real. I mean, when you look at the decision of the Supreme Court in Illinois not to allow them to stop paying pensions because it violates a contractual commitment, what are you going to do? They're now borrowing to pay for pensions when they can't afford those debts either. Mm-hmm. You know, you've come to the end of that game. Dick, you were going to say something.
Well, I think the other thing to remember is that with the Great Depression, the capitalists and the bankers were essentially brought to their knees by 1932. Because it was such a downward spiral, and their guy, Hoover, hadn't been able to do much about it. So in this crisis, the bankers were never undermined. The capitalists were never undermined, and they're still there to really throw vast amounts of money and support the Republican Party and the conservative Democrats and so on. So I think it's not just the way we think about government. I think it's also class power. The ruling class was much more brought to its knees, which allowed an opening. I'm not sure there was really a revolution brewing, but I do think it was a massive opening for popular forces to come to have their voices heard. And then once Roosevelt was in power and he started raising the taxes on the rich, you had a much more progressive income tax then than you do now, which continued, by the way, through the post-war era of prosperity and has been turned on its head. So the people who complained about taxes then were the rich because they were the ones being hit, whereas today the taxes have been so turned on their heads, it's all sales taxes and local fees and so on, like your kids in the school, PS 120. Yeah. The people paying these fees, and so they say, what am I getting for this? And they think, well, not much, because the business is in bed with government, and the goodies are going to them, going to military weaponry or whatever it is. So it's a very different feeling about government and what it can do and who it's doing it for, which I think Roosevelt was able to turn that on its head for a decade there. And, of course, he became more and more popular as time went on because people could see the results. They could see the rewards, the payoff, and he ended up the most popular American president ever.
And remember that Roosevelt also understood Wall Street because he'd worked there as an attorney. He was nobody's fool about how Wall Street operates. So when he comes in, he just cleans house. When Obama comes in, he does pretty much the opposite. He basically staffs his whole cabinet and his advisors with people from Wall Street, the people who had created the problem in 2008.
Let me stick you with a final question, given our time limits. If, as you say, and I know this is correct, that Roosevelt is the most popular president, reelected four times, no president had come even close to such a thing, and yet he's also the president who stands out as the man who did, in the end, impose taxes on corporations and the rich in order to take that money and do things for the mass of people, to make it simple. Mm. So here's something which today's politicians say is an impossible act. Even if I would like to do that, I can't because I couldn't survive politically. In the face of the history of the one time when we had a president who did it, who not only didn't not survive, but became the most popular. Why isn't there in the political mentality of this country the desire of politicians to replicate for themselves, even for the most self-interested reasons, to replicate what happened to Roosevelt by following in his footsteps politically? Why are they then not? And that question goes to Obama as well as all the folks around him.
Well, because they have to be reelected and they need massive, unbelievable amounts of money to do so. And it comes from the wealthy and from the corporations and so on. So
they're not going to take the risk.
They're not very democratic anymore. Our democracy has been fundamentally undermined in a way it hadn't been yet in the 1930s.
But they also don't understand history. You see, I mean, one of the reasons we're doing this is because this wasn't utopia. We actually did this, and it worked. It ended the Depression, contrary to what they said. But it sure looks like utopia from where we are now.
Well, I think that's a very important point that Gray brings out, that not only did this help save people's lives by putting them to work, that the New Deal actually worked, and there's a mythology on the right now that it never worked, that it didn't get us out of the Depression, and even the left buys that. You know, at our age, the new left of the 1960s, people were mad at Roosevelt for saving capitalism. So he said, well, really it didn't work, and bought into the line that only World War II got us out of the Great Depression. That's not true.
Please, go make that point, will you?
Yeah. Once Roosevelt was in, the economy was growing from 33 to 42 when the war starts for America at almost 10% a year. It's one of the fastest periods of economic growth in American history, also one of the fastest periods of productivity growth. It's quite astounding. There's one bad recession in 37, 38, partly because Roosevelt and the Federal Reserve Bank, tried to balance the budget and be conservative again, and it didn't work. But the New Deal absolutely worked, and a lot of that is based on figures that say, well, Unemployment only came down from 25% to 15%. Two things about that. One is that the data is wrong and they've been corrected. So it went down from 25 to 10%, which is a very big difference.
Right.
Because the person who did the statistics forgot to count the 8 million people and the 3 million people working for the WPA and the CCC and so on. And then the problem is, of course, capitalists, because productivity had gone up so much, they closed many, many old factories. So capitalists were not hiring at the same rate, even though GDP was going up dramatically and income was going up dramatically. And what the war did was absorb the final excess. Of course, the New Deal could have had even a double-sized WPA, and that would have helped, but they did so much, it's hard to criticize them for that.
Gray, we have only a few seconds. Any final thoughts?
Well, I guess what we're doing, actually, I started it as a book, but we found that there's so much stuff that it couldn't possibly be contained within the covers of a book. So it's become this website, The Living New Deal. So I hope people will look at it. And
tell us again what is exactly.
LivingNewDeal.org.
LivingNewDeal.org. Living New Deal is all one word.
Yes, that's right.
.org.
That's
and
okay.
People can not only go to it and learn about their particular regions, but they can also tell us about what they know about their regions, and we will add it to the map.
Yeah, it's a crowdsourcing kind of project.
Good. Thank you both, Richard Walker, Gray Brecken. Wish we had more time, maybe another time in the future. Thank you all for listening. I want to again thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis, for their interest and support. Many of you get the program through their intervention, which we appreciate. I want to remind you of our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Go to the websites, make use of them, comment to us, sign up for our free newsletter, follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You are part of this program, and we are appreciative and grateful to you for all the partnering you do. I look forward to being with you again next week. Yes, it is.